This is an appendix to episode 32 of the RSCP podcast, Pomegranate Health. That story is about diagnostic reasoning and cognitive error, and you can find it at the website rscp.edu.au/pomcast or any podcasting app. The file you're listening to now contains interview excerpts not included in the published story. It features Art Nahill and Nick Sheckett of Auckland City Hospital and the podcast I Am Reasoning. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. Well, that's it for Pomegranate Health listeners that haven't heard I Am Reasoning. It's well worth listening. It covers everything we're going to talk about today in a lot more depth. And for those who aren't familiar with the hosts, if you're hearing a Boston twang, that's Art. If you're hearing the idyllic shores of Lake Ontario, that's Nick.
I'm not sure. I think mine is a non-accent, I think.
My Boston twang has mellowed on considerably.
All right, let's run through a case study in the last kind of 10 minutes, whatever. And your job is to tell me where you think things went wrong or, you know, were predictable. I have to thank the quizmaster here, Professor Ian Scott, who's put together some of these for a resource we have on the RACP website. So Flynn is a 17-month-old boy. He was taken to the GP with a two-day history of temperature and sore throat. The GP found no signs of pus in the sore throat and diagnosed it as a viral illness. Over the next 2 days, Flynn developed vomiting and an erythematous rash spreading from his groin, under his arms and behind his knees. His parents brought him back to the clinic where a different GP fit Flynn into his busy schedule. And the doctor identified worsening tonsillitis and prescribed antibiotics this time. Later that evening, Flynn became irritable and more unwell. His rash had spread and he was taken to the local emergency department. The ED doctor had seen a lot of children presenting with viral illness over the preceding days and determined that the rash was either viral or a reaction to the antibiotics. She prescribed an antihistamine and sent Flynn home despite his parents' serious concerns. Flynn remained very unwell and lethargic, and the next day he was taken back to the GP, where he was seen by the original GP. The doctor noted the deterioration and immediately sent him to the paediatric hospital. Following admission, Flynn was diagnosed with streptococcal bacteremia. He was treated promptly and recovered well despite this near miss. So let's start from the beginning. The first GP who suggested it was a viral illness, was that reasonable with the information at hand?
Knowing nothing about 17-month-old patients.
Do I have an adult case here? No, a 74-year-old woman.
That's all right. So, I mean, I think the main problem that I saw here actually was a systems problem that may have led to some of the biases. The systems problem being discontinuity. And so the trouble of handovers and not having that ability to follow a patient along through the evolution of their disease. But anchoring, in terms of biases, anchoring seems to be what is most at play, because one doctor made decisions based on the speculations of the previous doctor, and it just kept on going down the line.
So the first GP, not neglecting base rates, I think given the fact that viral infections are far more common than streptococcal bacteremia, was probably not unreasonable to make that diagnosis, assuming that he or she had considered other things and that at presentation there were no sort of black swans or things that didn't quite fit with the presentation. But again, sounded appropriate. When there's handoff, there's a risk of framing bias, diagnostic momentum. That second individual who saw the patient, it's difficult once that diagnostic process has begun to derail it. And so, particularly if it's been framed as a case of tonsillitis, there's certainly those heuristics at play, I think, in that second presentation. And again, this relates in some ways to base rates, because when the base rates of things are high, the risk for availability bias is also high. And so, again, most of the time, the diagnosis would have been correct, except in this case, it wasn't.
And yeah, now the ED presentation, the ED doctor had seen a bunch of children with viral illness.
Yeah, I mean, that was an illustration of availability bias, because it was taking into account that there were multiple other cases of viral infection recently, that they stayed with that diagnosis, even though it seems clear that they were ignoring key features of the case that wouldn't have fit with a simple viral infection.
One of the users of the RACP's quiz workshop on this commented that this is a particular problem in pediatrics, where there is a lot of X about, there's a lot of this condition about, and you just kind of assume that children are diseased little critters that are sharing diseases. And the fact that, you know, Flynn was particularly unwell and his parents were worried, that often should be enough to monitor the patient for longer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we talk about often, not obviously in pediatrics, but, you know, with our own patients, is when there is uncertainty, and I would argue that at every step of this case until the very end, there was uncertainty, because there was never, as Art mentioned before, there was never a confirmatory test that you can call upon to give you certainty about the diagnosis you're making. And so whenever there is uncertainty, there's other possibilities, potentially dangerous ones, still lurking. And giving a follow-up plan is one of the main protectors from that situation. Giving warning signs to the patients, and even more, asking the patients to come back for another sighting to protect from maybe having missed something less common.
But again, I don't know from this, just from hearing this case, you know, were there any confirmatory tests that were done? I mean, I don't know if there was a throat swab or anything like that that could have suggested the diagnosis perhaps a bit earlier, or blood cultures. I mean, I don't know the sort of the routines for pediatric patients, but certainly the main ones, I think, have been the framing bias, availability bias, diagnostic momentum, and fortunately there was a good outcome.
And Pat Croskery, who's the director of the critical thinking program at Dalhousie University, similarly says that if we want cognitive errors to be more readily reported, we should remove the word bias, which has connotations of blame and finger pointing.
Yeah, so he's coined it cognitive dispositions to respond.
Which rolls off the tongue.
Oh, so well.
Yeah, I think that's why it hasn't caught on.
Even when you abbreviate it to CDR.
Yeah.
But he's got a point. Do you agree?
I completely agree. And that's, you know, to call something a bias, you know, that has a very pejorative connotation to it. And I do think it gives System 1 a bad rap. And I think that's part of where it comes from.
Again, in Gloria Kuhn's review, she says that the selection, selecting the short list of illness scripts is the most critical stage. Simulation studies in the 80s reveal that if the correct diagnosis wasn't contained in the initial short list of, say, 5 or 6 scripts, there was a large chance that diagnostic error would occur. The right script was never going to come up. There's probably no answer to this either, but is that because you're more likely to hover around the incorrect scripts you've pulled up, trying to make them fit the condition in front of you, rather than going back to scratch and admitting that you missed some important distinguishing feature?
I was going to say, that sounds right. That sounds like that's exactly the phenomenon that would probably happen. It may not even be that you're consciously not admitting that you were wrong, and that it's an embarrassment situation. It's not so much that; it's that you get anchored. You know, it's one of the biases that we recognize, and anchoring happens within your own mind. So when you think of the 3 or 4 most common things, you're not going to go beyond that most of the time. And if you relay that information in any way through documentation, through handover, whatever it is, to your colleagues, they're also not going to have other things come to mind. You know, every so often when we're doing teaching, we go through when Art and I do our Stump the Chumps episodes, we go through a very deliberate effort at using all the type 2 reasoning and think very carefully about all the possible diagnoses that could be at stake. That's not something that we do every day with our patients. Most of the time, we're using illness scripts, we're using intuition. We might take one step back and say, okay, we'll think of two other things that it might be just in case, but we're not doing an exhaustive analysis of the case.
And many of these biases sort of travel in groups. So once you've anchored onto a diagnosis, then something like confirmation bias comes into play, where any additional information you may get, you filter through what you already think the diagnosis is, such that you over-evaluate or overestimate the importance of some and underestimate the value of others. So once you've sort of begun that anchoring process, there are all these other clinical or cognitive biases that kind of come into play.
Well, this sort of speaks for itself, but it's common enough, overconfidence bias. Most people on the planet rate their skills and knowledge and instincts as being above average in whatever field. But unfortunately, we can't all be right. There was an interesting 1980 study that compared autopsies made at random to those that had been requested by the clinician who wasn't sure that they'd made the right call. And the proportion of diagnostic discrepancies was virtually identical between the two groups. In fact, the authors say, clinical confidence in the diagnosis is not an adequate assurance of its accuracy. How do you check your hubris on the way into the clinic?
Make a few mistakes, I guess, and
yeah, that'll check your hubris pretty quickly. I've never had this problem, I have to be honest. Well, I don't think I have. Maybe I'm deluding myself, but I've always felt very insecure about my decisions and my diagnoses from training and all the way to now. I mean, every so often I feel really good about a diagnosis that I've made because there's enough evidence there. But it's not because maybe it is because I had a good sleep or had a good breakfast.
But I think we have to unpack it a little bit in terms of, as a profession, I think confidence is very, very sought after, right? We all, I think, at heart, are underconfident, but the profession rewards us for being confident. We've had discussions with our juniors about what makes a good consultant or a good attending, and very often the answer is decisiveness. So somebody who's confident, somebody who can say what they think and move on with it. So that, I think, feeds into the problem. But the other problem really gets back to system one thinking. And that is that, as Daniel Kahneman uses frequently in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, with system one, what you see is all you get. So you don't know what you don't know, oftentimes, enough in order to be or to lack confidence in what you're doing. So part of it is system one, but part of it is also external kudos from the...
There are social pressures to be decisive. So we can say, often wrong, never in doubt.
Nice. And that probably makes the patient feel better as well if you're ahhing and ooh, maybe...
Yeah, well, this is something that we've been talking about quite a bit recently. I think there is some truth to inspiring confidence, whether it's inspiring confidence with your colleagues or with patients. But that does not necessarily translate into you have to be overconfident or to relay certainty to your patients. Relaying uncertainty is something that I do almost every day. I often have conversations with patients where my script is, I don't know what is happening with you. I'm not sure what the diagnosis is. Here are the things that I've ruled out, and these are the tests that we still have to do to gain a little bit more confidence in the diagnosis.
And there's a lot of overlap between some of these heuristics as well. And that makes me think about the difference between Occam's razor as a functional way of approaching a problem versus Hickam's dictum. So Occam's razor suggests that there is one parsimonious explanation for any given problem, whereas Hickam's dictum says that a patient can have as many problems as they damn well please.
It reminds me, the best imagery we probably got for what an illness script was and how it works was from Bob Trowbridge at one of his talks, who he's an internist and medical educator at Maine Medical Center. And he used the movie, what was it called? Inside Out, right? And he saw these illness scripts as little minions in your head who were always vying for attention. And as soon as the minion heard their name, they would jump up and down, you know, and holler and say, that's me, that's me. And so the illness script is supposed to...
I think you might be mixing up Disney movies.
You're right. You're right.
Minions are from Despicable Me. Now, I just have to be accurate about this.
What? Your kids are older. Why would you know this?
Because I watch it. It's a great film. I love that film.